Welcome to Ideas for the Future of Vermont, a podcast produced by GNAT TV and the Vermont Council on Rural Development.
Hello and welcome back to part 8 of a 10-part series GNAT TV and other community access centers across the Vermont Access Network are hosting in partnership with the Vermont Council on Rural Development and the Barry Times Argus and Rutland Herald newspapers. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director of GNAT TV's news project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. This 10-part series is about ideas for the future of Vermont and looks at what are some of the big questions that are facing the state as we emerge out of the pandemic and into whatever lies ahead. What are some of the big issues facing the state in coming years, and how will we go about tackling them? Upcoming topics in our series will include such things as investing in the working landscape and civic engagement. So far, some of the topics we've discussed include broadband development, welcoming new Vermonters, climate change and its relationship to the state's economy, and localizing food and energy. If you've missed one or want to get caught up in some of the previous discussions, you can visit the website futureofvermont.org/explore, and you can find not only the previous telecasts, but also the written opinion pieces that have been published in the Herald and the Times Argus that go along with these series of programs, and also the podcast versions of the shows, just in case you'd rather just listen to them. Today, our topic is about governance, and specifically, this 8th proposition reads, Vermont must reform regional coordination and governance and advance efficiency and foresight in state planning. With us today to discuss this point are Paul Costello, who is the Executive Director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development. Bill Schuwart is a retired businessman and an active fiction writer, and has served on a number of boards and legislative commissions and initiatives of statewide significance. We're also pleased to have with us today Justin Johnson, who has served as a former Secretary of Administration for Governor Peter Shumlin during the former governor's time in office. And today, Mr. Johnson works with the Montpelier lobbying firm MMR on a variety of state and national policy issues. Gentlemen, thank you for making the time for this discussion today. Great to have you all here.
Thank you, Andy.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Paul, I thought we could look to you to get us started here. And as I was preparing for this discussion today, I came across this study or report that the Vermont Council on Rural Development put together back in 2006. Seems like a long time ago, in a way, where you talked about planning and regional coordination, the very topic we're discussing today. You evaluated the structure of the planning system of Vermont and considered ways of strengthening planning efforts and their outcomes to Vermont communities. And I'll just quote for a moment here. You said in the executive summary of that report, much of the testimony pointed out that Vermont is at a crossroads. While Vermont has made significant progress in the development and implementation of plans, and many planners at all levels of government throughout Vermont are doing excellent work, the system is challenged by gaps in communication, collaboration, and implementation, and the promise of the system and the law is only partially fulfilled. So I guess my question is to have you get us started here is, how far have we come in the last 15 years since 2006? Or if you were writing that report today, would you still be saying a lot of the same things, or have we moved on a bit?
Great question, Andrew. I don't think we've come a long way. I think that the strengths of the system and the strengths of the people who are working in our regional planning and our local planning offices and the agency plans that are developed are all strong, but nobody's adding them up. You know, one of the fundamentals that we found back in 2006 was that regional plans are useful within their regions, but there's not really an assigned point of leadership at the state level that looks at what all those plans mean when we look at the statewide land use pattern or the way that we encourage economic development for the future. So there's some disconnect there. It's interesting that the Council on Planning had that finding. Later, the Council on the Future of Vermont looked at this as an issue that was fundamental. And the legislature a few years ago set up a commission on government restructuring and operational reviews to look at efficiency in government, and it found the same issue. It's perennial. We're a state with a two-year gubernatorial cycle, two-year legislative cycle, one-year budget cycle. And there's not any one place where people are responsible to looking 5 years, 10 years out at the future of our economy and the future of economic development. And, you know, part of the strength of democracy is that there are a lot of people engaged collectively in building plans and advancing plans locally and regionally. These are people who come through democratic process and are empowered by that. But we're missing something when we don't add up those plans, especially in times like these, where we need to think in a more concerted way, as we have to respond to COVID, as we should be when we think about climate change and other sort of broad sectoral issues that are bigger than you can handle at the local or regional level. The other side is there's been a long dialogue, and the Council on the Future of Vermont noted this. And talking to Secretary Johnson, we years ago had some conversations around the delivery system for state services. Some people say Vermont is the most centralized state in the country because there's the 251 towns and then there's the state. And so either the state's making decisions or the towns are, but the towns are in effect legally, they're subject to the state. And then we have regional planning commissions and regional development corporations and waste districts and police and fire districts. And we historically as a state have added up more and more districts. Back probably 20 years ago, John McLaughlin and his partners put together the Vermont papers that looked at the overlay of these service territories, which when you look at a map of Vermont with all those territories overlaid, you see black. It's like such a dense spider web, you can hardly see through it, because the historical accretion of services hasn't corresponded to rational delivery areas for co-location, for convenience of the customer. And how do we look at that as a big issue? So what the proposition really says, we should look at these two issues together, coordinated planning and the evolution towards more rationalized delivery of regional services. It's a lot.
Well, Bill, Justin, I'd like to hear you weigh in on this as well. Who wants to go first? Justin, you look like you want to go first.
Sure. So, you know, and I'll just say, you know, I'm a relative newcomer to the state. I've only been here since the mid-90s. And it still feels like I'm a relative newcomer. And I was pretty surprised when I first got here at this sort of mixed web of an overlay of different government organizations and their size and that sort of thing. And I've spent certainly my time in government and even since, you know, sort of trying to nut out in my mind how this happened. How did we end up here? And I think in part it's almost as though we are in a really slow transition from something from a long time ago to something we haven't quite got to yet. It's like we're holding on as tight as we can to this really small town, locally controlled, you know, individual sort of notion of little towns doing their thing. And yet we're doing that in a global economy where we need to be more nimble. We need to lower our, for want of a better term, our transactional cost in government in particular. And it's because that cost really shows up for people. And, you know, as I said, I haven't been here forever, but I think it, you know, you can trace it all the way back to, you know, at the original implementation of Act 250, I think in the early 70s. And for those folks who remember that, my understanding is there was at the time a lot of conversation about a companion sort of statewide planning law that would go along with it. So you had the Act 250, and then you had this planning proposal. And of course, in true Vermont fashion, we did one of part of it and then we didn't do the other. We were going to work on that and we're still working on that. And so you still have, even though you have the Act 250 overlay as an example, you have a ton of towns that have no zoning. And so that's just one example of the challenge. But, you know, as I said, I was shocked. I mean, I came here from Australia just as an example. It is the size of the continental US. It has the population of New York State. It has 7 police forces, 6 school districts, and 6 states, you know, and 1 district. You know, as an example. And so I think at the heart of this conversation, we've got to get to the transactional cost of government. And very much tied to that, and what we shouldn't forget is that people's desire to have control over the decisions in their lives is sort of fighting against, I think, some of the efficiency we're looking for.
All right, Bill, your turn.
Well, I would agree with a lot of what Justin has said. I often get asked if I'm a native Vermonter, and I say, well, you mean Abnaki? And that immediately gets me off on the wrong foot in any conversation. But I grew up in Morrisville and lived here since 1947. And the whole fantasy of local control and the dynamic tension between communities and state has existed for as long as I've been, you know, conscious of political activity. It's never been fully resolved. I've seen, you know, top-down initiatives like Act 250 succeed. The billboard law, you know, that succeeded and people bought into it. And I've seen, you know, other top-down initiatives like school consolidation and so on create a firestorm, especially at the community level. In fact, there's a lot going on right now about, you know, what's the relationship between public education and childcare? Why are we building childcare facilities and shutting down local schools? And that discussion is absolutely polarized between state and local, you know, citizens. And, it's a real issue. To me, the problem distills down to really 3 areas. And Paul mentioned some of them. One is we have a 1-year budget planning process. Does anyone know of a $7 or $8 billion enterprise that has a 1-year budget planning process? I mean, it defies reason. We also have no strategic planning and haven't had any since Governor Dick Snelling was there, and the strategic planning was taken out for, I guess, cost-saving reasons. Again, I would ask, can you imagine a $7 or $8 billion enterprise that doesn't do strategic planning? And the other sort of macro issue that I would put out there is the lack of leadership, which I tie very deeply to the 2-year term. I've been asked for 2 decades to come in and testify about why we need a 4-year term. And I won't repeat all the arguments because they're at this point cliches. But we cling to this idea of a 1-year budget cycle and a 2-year term of governance. And we don't want to spend money on strategic planning. But we're very happy to go out and hire consultants on the West Coast for $300,000 or $400,000. When I chaired the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission, we hired a consultant from California who happened to be terrific. But I've seen other legislative initiatives where the consultant, frankly, from what everything I've read, was kind of a waste of money, was sort of off-the-shelf solutions. The other thing that's really complicated in Vermont and Hinesburg, the town I live in, is right next to Charlotte. And, you know, I see Charlotte going through this. Charlotte's the wealthiest town in Vermont. I always would have assumed it was Stowe or Woodstock or Manchester. It's actually Charlotte. And it's a town divided. and it's divided along the lines of wealth. And having grown up in Morrisville, which was the service community for Stowe, when Stowe was coming, becoming the town of great wealth in Vermont, I just saw this process play out. And when I did chair the Legislative Commission on Taxation, on rethinking taxation, we commissioned a tremendous amount of research before we actually began to have the discussions. And because we wanted it to be based in fact. And one of the things that popped out that surprised all of us was at that time, which was about 8 or 9 years ago, Vermont had the second highest polarity of wealth per capita of any state in the union. And that's not a bad thing. It's not a reason to be upset or be worried. But as I've often said, I worry in our discussions or lack thereof that the polarization that we all assume is liberal conservative, and I would argue that it's not, that there are a lot of places in liberal and conservative areas where people can agree if that's the discussion. I would say the polarization is much more around protecting privilege. And protecting privilege can be my right to have a gun or my right to have a trailer park or you know, my right to, you know, whatever. So those are sort of the macro issues. I think the issue of planning and execution really does come down to leadership. One of the mistakes that we consistently make is our understanding of leadership is that it involves absolute unanimity and agreement. We have a tendency in Vermont not to do anything until every last person has signed off on it. And the definition of leadership really is somebody who derives consensus, who elicits dissent, and who records and honors dissent. But when push comes to shove, if 70 people want to do it and 30 don't, there's a commitment to do it. And you do it. And that seems to be so often where we fail, because some group comes roaring forward and says, well, I didn't agree to that. And it's like, oh, well, you know. So anyway, I've said a lot. So I'll.
Well, Justin, back to you for a second. I guess I was wondering, one of the first thoughts that popped into my mind as I was thinking about this was whether or not, you know, and I think it's already been alluded to, whether or not there was this contradiction between Vermont's cherished tradition of local control and town government and efficient regional coordination. As a former New Yorker, I was used to thinking in terms of, you know, countywide government. And that's a question I'd like to throw out at you. Also, whether or not perhaps part of the solution here might be in establishing a stronger county level government, sort of as an in-between Manchester and Manchester, Montpelier and the various towns. But I guess, is there like sort of this irreconcilable conflict, do you feel, between the whole idea of local control and an efficient regional coordination?
So it depends, because I think, so just to go back to what Paul said at the beginning, you know, the town government in Vermont is a creature of a creation of the legislature. It doesn't have any sort of constitutional, it's not designated in any way except that the legislature created it, which is why we see the charter changes for various towns come back to the legislature and be turned into a bill, because it is a creation of the legislature. So, you know, arguably the legislature could recreate it, uncreate it, create it in a different way. That would be a very ugly conversation, let me tell you. Having lived through one of those in another country, I can tell you that different place, same ugly outcome. But it is a challenge, because one of the things I used to say about Vermont when I was Secretary of Administration is we're too big to be small and we're too small to be big, right? Because, you know, even for us, you know, you're from New York, you know, the New York Department of Environmental Conservation has 15 offices around the state, and there is no question that they're going to have an office out in, you know, Rochester or somewhere out in Western New York, because you're never going to be able to run everything from Albany. Someone's not going to drive that far. Same sort of thing with the DMV. And I just saw it again this week. The DMV is saying, well, maybe we don't reopen some of these offices. And I'm just using that as an illustration. You know, you have a state government department. Does it have regional offices? How many does it have? How big are they? Where are they? Well, gee, you know, it's only 2 hours from, you know, well, you can't get there from here to go east to west half the time. And, you know, it's a long way north to south, but it's not that long. You know, it's like, well, maybe we could save a bunch of money and not have this office. And then that leads to the conversation. Everything's being concentrated in Montpelier. So I think, you know, the upshot of all that is, if I was king for a day, I think that I would keep municipal. I mean, I think the municipal services, you know, the things that are done at the municipal level, sort of roads, municipal roads, even trash to a point where it's done at the municipal level, municipal ordinances around dog parks and all those sorts of things absolutely should be at the municipal level. You know, I'll get beaten up for this, but I still think we have way too many school districts. Not necessarily the way you manage the school, but the governance behind it, I think, is way too complicated and therefore expensive. We spend too much money on the districts and not enough on the kids, is in my view. But then, you know, and Paul touched on this as well, things like trash collection, fire services. You know, I like to use examples because it's really easy to talk about all this sort of thing in sort of abstract. But I would say the conversation that has gone on in my neck of the woods for the last, I don't know, 7-10 years about whether Montpelier, Berlin, Barry City and Barry Town should have a joint fire service somewhere close by. And in my view, that is an absolute no-brainer. We've had, I don't know how many hundreds of meetings about bringing together the dispatch service for those four communities that I could drive to all of and be back at this computer before you finish this episode. And we are still arguing about whether they should be separate or together and how they would be together. Something like that should absolutely be regional. And I think you could throw in some of the solid waste districts and that sort of thing. So when I say it depends, I think, you know, the things you would have to put aside to have the conversation or work through what should be local and what should be regional and what state, the step you have to take to get there is really the step that's been holding us back from any number of these conversations for years. And I think if we could just take that step and just put aside all of our wanting to hold on to everything for a little while, it would sort of naturally fall out a little bit. And you know, I think it's important that you don't just focus on efficiency. You know, government is not private industry. It's not set up to be that. It can use some principles from private industry, the sort of the desire to be efficient in your transactional cost, as I call it, in private industry is something that government could learn a lot from. But that does not mean that that's what you are. I mean, it would be a disaster to run government like a business, but the principles do hold true. And I think that we could do well to sort of learn a little bit from that and just step back from where we are, you know, from our hold on everything.
Yeah, and I think that starts with discussion, dialogue, conversation about what works, democratic process, and that can come from the ground up. You know, when John McClary and Bill Mayers wrote the Vermont Papers, they envisioned regional shires, which would localize functions together at the sub-county level. So in Bennington County, they think of Manchester and Bennington as two shires within that county with the circle towns around them. And what is the appropriate level for certain services? There are places where there are three fire departments within one town because the different villages or different parts of towns organize those historically. But realistically, they don't need to be mandated to come together. It should be local decision-making, but local discussion about how do we work together. One of the things that we see, you know, we start community projects all over the state. We've pulled tens of thousands of people together to build 400 some odd new projects and communities. And one of the things you see is that in some places, you know, Vermont has more nonprofits per capita than any place else in the United States. Then we have all these local boards. So in one town, you have leaders that might be on the select board. They may also be on the cemetery commission. They may also be on the waste district commission and the regional planning district. And we need to broaden inclusion for more people in leadership, for more diversity in leadership, for more youth in leadership, all that. But even so, the efficiency isn't just about money. It's about our own human capital. How many places can you put your heart on the line at the same time to drive things forward for your community? And if you had a little bit bigger table, you'd be able to have a little bit more influence in decisions that would be broader. You might be using the human capital more wisely. So for us, it's not about trying to have a dictate come down from Montpelier that's going to tell towns what to do, because that's not going to work. It's more, how do we work together? And you see regional planners and regional development folks who are doing some really brilliant work in support of their communities right now. They're indispensable. But aren't they two sides of the same coin? And, you know, you have in Bennington County and in the Northeast Kingdom, co-location of those offices and coordination between the development and planning functions. Is that a model that other places could emulate? Keep your separate staff, but work more effectively. When you think about the Agency of Agriculture and it's being relatively centralized, could they have a staff person in every county or every regional office like this? Could the Agency of Human Services do that? Could we look at how things that function for community and economic development, small business development center and other services that state and even the feds produce could be connected so that people wouldn't be, you know, racing from place to place or driving to Montpelier to connect with folks that they ought to have access to more locally. And so, you know, this whole part of the proposition is really asking these big questions and asking us to think a little bit more about our historic moment in the way we might want to make decisions about how we work more effectively together, community to community throughout Vermont.
To your point, Paul, one of my deep memories is when I think about growing up in Morrisville, my first jobs were on a farm, obviously. And you know, when a farmer was in trouble, they didn't go to their minister and said, "Will you pray for my cows?" They didn't go to the police department. The authority in the small towns that I remember with all the hill farms was the extension agent. And that's a really good example of what you're talking about. They were all connected to the University of Vermont. They had scientific resources. So when a farmer was in some kind of peril, the first person they turned to was their extension agent. And I just wanted to throw in one other thing, you know, to what you were saying, Justin. Hinesburg is about, I don't know, 12 miles from Church Street. Within 15 miles of Church Street, we have 9 fire departments, 9 police departments, and 9 EMT groups. And until recently, they each had their own, dispatch system. They finally combined the dispatch. But then you get into, at what point does local control move from being about the community to being about boys and their toys? You know, how many $300,000 fire trucks does an area with a 30 square mile radius need? You know, how many ambulances? And again, those are the questions we have to be asking. And again, to me, this all devolves to leadership. I don't hear leaders coming out and saying, wait a second, let's look realistically. What can we afford? What can we do more efficiently? And I noticed that I don't know if it's a secretary or cabinet level position, but the head of government efficiency in Vermont is stepping down. And I've only served on one business board all my life, and the woman who ran it was Vermont Smoke and Cure. She was a professional optimizer. And I didn't really know what that was, but her job was to come in, look at every single process, every person, all the infrastructure, and say, we can do this better. We can produce a better product. We can produce more profit. We can take care of our employees and our markets. And here's what we need to do. And I thought to myself, is that what the government efficiency person is supposed to do? And do they just have an office and a desk? Do they have a budget? Do they have any authority? But I mean, that feels to me like something we could really look at. But we have this tendency in Vermont to say, oh my gosh, every state in the union except Vermont has a head of creative economy. We'll put up $200,000, we'll get them a desk and an office, and we'll have a head of creative economy, or we'll have a head of efficiency. But it doesn't sink in. It doesn't have the legislative and the executive branch championship or the budget or the authority or even the definition. I was talking with a couple of business people and I said, so what is this position of government efficiency? They said, never heard of it. You know, so
that's a great point. I think, that also goes back to leadership in a big way. And frankly, I think when it comes to government, it goes back to the 2-year term. You know, it's in order to, so in government, basically, it's all about the money, right? It's about who has control of the money and where the money goes. I had a fairly powerful position as Secretary of Administration, not because the Secretary of Administration is any higher than any other secretary in the cabinet, theoretically, although it was pointed out, I think it was in a Supreme Court decision once, that the Secretary of Administration was referred to as a first amongst equals, but that's only because they controlled the money. And if you want to find out what government's priorities are, then look at where they spent money, because it's the ultimate sort of barometer of priorities. And I think you're absolutely right. Any things like efficiency, they've suffered a lot in state government and sort of default the rest of the state, because the legislature has an idea, the administration has an idea. Sometimes one of them gets a leg up on the other one, and then just when everyone thinks that something might happen, a different idea comes along as a different shiny object, and everyone goes to sort of look at that. And I think what you get amongst the staff is, if they don't like an idea, they just wait it out, because with 2-year terms and things, you don't have to wait that long. I mean, it's not that hard of a thing to wait it out. I think there is a real lack of sort of vision in that sense, because it seems to me leadership around these things is about creating a clear enough vision that you can get people to buy into that vision and then pick it up and go and do it. Because I don't care who the governor is or the speaker or the pro tem, no one person can do all this on their own. So a true leader is someone who has a clear vision and then co-opts everyone into it, not by force, but by force of good ideas and clarity in what they're trying to achieve. And so then we all go out and do our thing, and we know what to do because we share the vision. And I think sometimes we miss that. I sort of almost going back to this idea that we're trying to drag ourselves out of, one sort of vision of who we are and to something else. We're just not sure who the something else is. I was fascinating to me when I first arrived here to hear these every 2-year sort of conversations about Australian ballot and which, and then which towns had Australian ballot and which didn't, and how it was a horrible thing that we're, you know, the world's gone to the dogs since we got rid of the town meeting and went to Australian ballot. Because I'm from Australia and I'm like, what the hell are they talking about? This Australian ballot thing. I've since worked it out, but at the time I was like, this is the weirdest thing ever. But you know, I think that the ability for us to sort of come together around a vision in some ways is lacking a little. And you know, that might change given the amount of money we're about. I mean, you've probably talked about this in the broadband segment, but I think, you know, one of the challenges for Vermont is our geography and the fact that, you know, we're close, but it's not that easy to get to. And so, you know, meetings are hard to get pulled together, particularly in the winter, that sort of thing. And maybe broadband, you know, I think it brings us closer together in some ways, but there's going to be a rude shock for a lot of people also, because it also brings everything that we want to hold outside in with it. And I think that also is going to require some vision about where we're going to sort of sort through.
I was wondering if both of you thought a really good argument in favor of more regionalism in the state government and might also address the leadership issue you both raised would be to argue that a more regional approach would save money and therefore reduce property taxes, which seemed to be the third rail in Vermont politics, or at least a surefire way of making something seem attractive if we could somehow lower property taxes. I know that was an argument that was made on behalf of the Act 46 proposal when it was being you know, discussed in the legislature, that your consolidation would you know, curb expenses in some way. I'm not sure of how, to what extent that's happened yet, and it may be too soon to know, but I guess I just wondered, do you think a more regional approach is more cost efficient or could be more cost efficient and therefore politically popular with a lot of folks because their property tax bills are be going down?
I think Justin's point earlier really is relevant. I I wrote a column, which I'm particularly good at doing because of my own struggle with food, about Vermont needing to lose weight. And it started out with a look at the budget we've just passed is $7.2 billion. There's a couple of more billion coming in from the Fed, some of which is specific and some of which is not local option, but state option as to how we spend it. If you just put that together at $9 billion and you look at 620,000 people, that comes to, I don't have the numbers right in my head, it's either $14,000 or $17,000 per person and something like $42,000 per household. Again, and don't hold me, those numbers are pretty close. I just don't remember them exactly. And the fact that we cannot conduct the business of statecraft in Vermont with that kind of money is staggering to me. And it makes me want to look really hard at where are we wasting money? You know, why are we closing local schools and building daycare centers? Might they not be the same thing? Might we just need to rethink public education to get us to that place? The other thing is I spent a lot of time because at a crisis point, I was chair of the Fletcher Allen Hospital. And have gotten much deeper into healthcare than I want to. And I've been talking with a couple of hospital CEOs and, you know, about what we're doing here. And it makes me think, and I won't digress on that, but we also have to remember there are more spheres than community, region, and state. There's the federal government. And as you pointed out just in the beginning, there's the global. And these all exert influence on our decision-making or lack thereof. And a lot of what, and you lived through this, Justin, a lot of what we wanted to do in healthcare, the problem wasn't entirely internal. Some of it was federal. And, you know, if you have a multi-payer system, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, and so on and so forth, you can't just say, okay, we're going to do this. We have a vastly overexpensive healthcare system. We have 14 hospitals when we probably need 7 or 8. We need more local clinics, less hospitals. We need to, and people will argue this, if we move our investments upstream, as one hospital head said to me, you know, I got to tell you, my business model is completely predicated on having a steady stream of broken people that I can fix at very high transactional cost. That's how I keep from going bankrupt. If you want to give me a capitated system, then I can move my investment upstream and I can focus on population health. Of course, I'll maintain the clinical practice and fix people who are broken. But my goal is to have less people broken. I'd like to come into the emergency room some night and find it empty. And, but again, you know, we, until we understand and take a much larger view, I mean, my whole point in raising healthcare is that it's not just within Vermont. There we've got immense pressure from the federal government. We need waivers for everything we try. But I think one over the years that I've thought about these things, like you all have, the one thing that makes clear logical sense to me is if we move our investments upstream, if we really move them from remediation and repair, like corrections, if you take that $160,000 and you invest that upstream to keep people out of corrections, you know, mental health, you know, our health system just looks at mental health as a black hole. Oh, we don't want to do that. That's way too complicated. You know, but if we can move those investments upstream, we can cut our cost of repair and remediation. To me, that's just vital.
So I think I think one of the biggest challenges we have when it comes to government and government efficiency and how our process around government works is, I think the number one thing you need in order to change that, to make meaningful change, let's say we decide that we want to regionalize government a bit more. You know, we're going to try and bring some of these things that spread across towns but aren't quite at the state level, bring them together. And I mean, I think we could propose that all day long. The biggest thing that's missing right now, and it's sort of a chicken and egg thing, it's a product of the lack of leadership, but you know, Bill's piece about the outside forces plays here, because I think the other thing that's really missing in this moment is trust in government and the polarization around that. And that is something that, you know, Vermonters have always had, I think, a healthy skepticism of government, but the straight up mistrust has been imported in recent years, right? And it's coming at us fairly briskly, I would say. You know, I think that the polarization in the conversation, to get back to your point, Paul, which I agree with, that, you know, ultimately the way to sort this out is to have dialogue around it. But the polarization in the public conversation is absolutely killer to this sort of effort to try and work. Because if I was to propose, you know, in my grand plan where we have one school system in the state, you know, it doesn't get off the ground just because someone will assume that, you know, I've got a sort of party political bent on one side and then you're automatically against it. And I would argue that you can make pretty much any system work if you are prepared to work with the system. And you could make the best design system a disaster if you sort of ignore the fundamental things about what you're trying to do, which is to, you know, when you're in government, I think help people, be people-focused and people-centric, to do things at the least cost possible so that people can you know, the old adage, keep more of their money and make their decisions about what they want to do with it. And there's any number of systems that can deliver that, and they can all do it either well or badly depending on how the people within them act. And right now I think we have a huge trust problem in even having the conversation, which is unfortunate.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, culture trumps strategy, trumps tactics. We don't have enough of a conversation about our culture and what we stand for together in terms of all these issues, everything from civility online to the discussion around what we need to do for our children to be successful in the future. We have the dialogue around the future of education that leads to Act 46. You know, it's a little bit like legislators looking for their wife's wedding ring under the lamppost instead of in the forest where she lost it, because there's more light where the lamppost is, and they know more about governance and budgets than they do about the function, purpose, vision, and values for the future of education. You know, how do we want our children to be able to participate in global opportunities online? How do we work cooperatively to give any child that wants to learn Chinese or French the opportunity in the state of Vermont? That's not an insurmountable thing. How do we help teachers be facilitators of children's experiences outside of a building and participating in vocational practice that helps them build a sense of direction in their lives? But we start on the wrong end. And because of that, lots of conversations turn tactical first. And when you think about the political process, it drives you into tactical disagreements and you concentrate on the thing you disagree with. And with the 2-year cycle and 1-year budget, we spend a lot of time talking tactics, and secretaries of administration will say, I don't have time to think forward about what we're going to do in 5 years. I got to respond to this legislator today. I'm getting pushed. And so people are already always pushed. And, you know, I like what you said, you know, about vision. And I don't criticize governance. I think that our current governor has done a remarkable job of building trust in an extremely difficult environment. And he's made a historic impact for that. So good on him. But when you think about who's responsible for vision, person's elected for a 2-year term, they carry what vision they can, and then they get into tactics, right? And there's no one who's being paid in a ship with a $9 billion budget. You know, when you think about what happens with state government over time, you build new programs or you increase funding on the ones that are more important. The ship of state floats a little bit higher, but you haven't necessarily invested in its steerage. You know, where's the ship of state going? What's the path forward for Vermont for the next generation? And how do we have some continuity? And how do we focus so that as people invested in democracy, you know, and we're coming out of a time where democracy's been tested. We have the attempted overthrow of a presidential election in our own time. And where we need to say, we actually have values in common. We do believe in justice together. We do believe in equality and equity for every American. You know, we do have some things we believe in. And it feels to me like coming through COVID and through the national debacle we've had, it's a time to really regain some of those values and recommit, not to a top-down strategy that dictates, you know, which organizations work together, but instead a mutual conversation to say, how's democracy going to work for the next generation? How are we going to work to improve the life of our communities in the most effective, efficient way we can? And that it's not just our moral responsibility to have that conversation. It's our civic duty. And it's part of what we need to do to redefine patriotism that includes everybody. I almost hate to use the word because it's so loaded as something that has divided us, when we need to say, yeah, I stand for Vermont. And that means for all of you, not just for my little clan. And when I think about the future of this country, I stand with you. And until we get to that point, we're not going to realize our best destiny as a people, it seems to me. And so we need to have this kind of conversation.
I think the other real challenge for Vermont in all of that is that, you know, we have a huge lack of workforce. We have a lack of younger people. And, you know, I really commend the governor on coming out and saying, hey, when you guys at the federal level decide to reopen immigration, put us on the list. Mm-hmm. But keep in mind that that is going to be a difficult thing for a state where you've got a group of people who don't want to let go of this picture they have, you know, their Norman Rockwell picture of the world. And we're saying our best hope for the future, our best chance of actually having something, you know, in the future is to bring in a bunch of outsiders. That is going to be a tough transition. And so knowing who we are, having a sense of ourselves and being comfortable about that is going to be a really important piece, because if we just fight for what we used to have or this picture of what we think it should be like, that's going to make it really uncomfortable for all the new people we need to somehow encourage to come here.
Bill, I just wanted to quickly get your have you talk a little bit about the opinion piece that you had published in the Herald and the Times Argus, where you suggested that the state should have a Strategic Planning Resource Council, or SPRC to go with the acronym, a body that doesn't yet exist, as you point out. But I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what you were thinking that the mission of this this council would be.
Yeah, I'm going to hearken back to a discussion I had with Governor Scott at his request. It was actually about economic development, but it was very wide ranging. And I talked about the lack of strategic planning, and his response was, but Bill, the last thing we can afford is another agency of government. You know, and I said, with all due respect, Governor, you've got 1,000 men and women in Vermont of all kinds of diversity, socioeconomic diversity, geographic diversity. There are people who think hard and long about what Vermont is, what the future of Vermont is. You could, in association with the legislative and the judiciary branch, you could pick 9, 11, 13, you know, of these people. They could be appointed by different groups. They could serve for 3 years. You could pay them $1,000 a year honorarium, and you could give them a basic administrative budget with an office so they could have meetings, their travel could be paid for, and so on and so forth. You're not talking a multi-million-dollar agency. You're probably talking $400,000 or $500,000 to actually have a roadmap. As Paul said, you know, you're steering over the stern of the ship. You know, we're a reactive state. You know, a dead body goes by. Oh, we need a law. Some sewage floats by on the right. Oh, we need a law. You know, we've got to start looking forward. And to me, when you begin to do that, you have the opportunity to provide much higher quality service and also to much better manage cost.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I just wanted to, before we go, have Paul tell us a little bit about the summit meeting that the Council on Rural Development has planned for May 26th and 27th. What's going to be going on, Paul?
Well, this is the 8th in the series of TV shows. We're going to have deep discussions with panels on each of these propositions again. The 26th, we'll have those in the first half of the afternoon. And then we're going to have diverse voices commenting on how they all add up. So we'll have a section with farmers, a session with immigrants to Vermont, a session of legislative leaders and other groups that will be evaluating these ideas and thinking about the big picture of how they add up and how they connect to their vision for Vermont's future. The next day, the 27th, will be no presentations whatsoever. It will be listening to the participants who've reflected on this overnight and their ideas and strategies to how we work together in Vermont to move some of these big pieces of agenda forward. We're going to be adding that all up. We're going to be framing an action plan from this endeavor. We've got drafts in place that we're going to be releasing in the next couple of weeks to everyone who attends the sessions. We do this in all humility. We know we haven't got it right. We're not writing a manifesto and we don't have power over any of it, but we're going to bring these to people and they're going to have an opportunity to check in on those, help us adjust it. And ultimately, we're going to build a working draft and build a board to lead that draft forward that will be a group that will serve as a convening entity for the future to say, well, for this proposition on childcare or this proposition on welcoming new people of color to Vermont, we need to do these five things. Who are the organizational partners that could help do that? What's it going to take to get that off the ground? Where would we go together for resources to move that? Are there public policy needs that we need to advance to move that? And in some cases, we'll cheer the heck out of the governor and legislature for putting big dollars in something. We're never going to be an opposition group. We're going to be raising aspirations in positive direction that aren't Republican or Democratic, but really look to, as best we can, celebrate core of Vermont values. So the 26th, 27th, and we'll be building other processes to carry positive political messages to key leadership to advance these different initiatives over the next couple of years too. So for us, this is a foundation of something of a five-year plan of work. Not work that we own and control, but of partnership and working with Vermonters to move a big picture agenda at this really historic moment. So we invite everyone to come to register for the summit. You can go to www.futureofvermont.org. It's got that / Justin Explore. And Explore, you'll find the registration page. We've got 115 speakers signed up, including Justin and Bill. And it's going to be a pretty sensational event. So we encourage everyone to come. We hope you're going to come, Andrew.
Well, it's on my calendar.
Good.
Well, okay, boy, I got a funny feeling we could talk about this subject for another hour if we had the time, but we're going to have to leave it there for today. But I just want to thank Bill Schubert and Justin Johnson for being with us. And of course, Paul Costello, great to have you all here today. And just want to mention that next week for Proposition 9 out of the 10-part series, we'll be talking about how Vermont must protect our lands and waters and advance the economy of the working landscape. So hope you will have time to tune in then or catch it on a website somewhere and hear what the folks have to say. Meanwhile, thank you all for being with us again and have a great day. We'll see you next time.
You have been listening to Ideas for the Future of Vermont, a podcast produced by GNAT TV and the Vermont Council on Rural Development. Thank you for listening local.